The podcast you are about to listen to discusses comic books and comic book related media. Be warned, the following will review art, plot, and themes, and will therefore contain spoilers of the materials discussed. Welcome to Comics League International. I'm Brent.
And I'm Lydia.
And we are Brent and Lydia Talk Starman.
Starman! All right. Yay!
I know. This is episode number 27, where we are going to talk about Starman number 24, Demon Quest, part 1 of 3.
Demon Quest.
Yes. Gotta catch them all. Wait, no, that's something different.
Pokemon!
Starman. Wrong fandom.
Okay. Starman, yes. Alright, so this was published in November 1996. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good, I've got it right.
Or so. You know, that's the cover date, blah blah blah, publishing is blah 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 blah.
Oh right.
Yeah, you know.
See? I still get it wrong.
Well, I mean, I still do it, and because I say published, and I realize, well, because you got, like, the purists out there who are going to be like, no, it wasn't published in November, it was actually blah. I'm just like, man, okay, cover date, sure.
Okay. Cover date. November 1996. Got it. Yes, and I'm having Darjeeling tea with milk.
That is, you know, normally I don't do so much tea. I do like tea, but I always forget about it. But I'm actually sipping on a nice thing of some. It says green tea on the thing, but I'm pretty sure it's a genmaicha.
Oh, nice!
Has that kind of earthy flavor to it?
It's
What would you call that? Roasted rice.
Roasted
green
rice
tea? Is that?
Yeah, I have one of those cups. Those glasses, which has a vacuum in between. So it's like, it's nice and warm. It's going to be nice and warm. Yay! Okay, guys, let's talk about November 1996.
Enough for tea time. Now it's on this day.
Yes. I picked up just one thing. It's very geeky. I'm not much of a mathematician.
Wait. Is it more or less geeky than talking about every single issue of Starman?
It's probably a lot more geeky, I guess.
You're pushing the bounds.
Yes, I know. On November 13th, 1996, Joel Armengaud, I think that Armengaud, I don't know how to say his name, Armengaud, Armengaud. Sorry, Joel, if you're listening. He discovers 2 to the power of 1398269 minus 1. this thing called a Mersenne Prime. Have you heard of it?
No. You just made my brain hurt a little bit.
Why I'm saying this is because I'm actually married to a physicist. or rather, I'll call him a physics teacher, but he's still, you know, physics is his life. And so I don't know, it rubs off on me a little bit. I'm nothing near being a fan of mathematics, but this was quite interesting. Okay, because I don't know if you find it interesting.
I want to hear it.
Okay, it's interesting for me because you know, there are prime numbers, right? Prime number. Okay, for those of you who are listening who don't know what prime numbers are, yes, it's it has no positive divisions other than 1 and itself, which means it can only be divided by itself and 1. So that's a prime number. And there's a kind of prime number. See, that this is the geeky thing. I did not know prime numbers had types, and they have names.
and you gotta catch them all.
Oh, you know, literally, there are people trying to catch them all because this is what happened. This is what happened on November 13th. This guy, he caught the 35th one. I'm not kidding. This is true. So this type of prime number is called a Mersenne prime. It's a prime number that is one less than a power of 2. So I'm not very educated about this, but I just thought it was firstly very fascinating that prime numbers had types, and that there are only a set number of known Mersenne primes. As of January 2016, 49 Mersenne primes are known, which means since November 96, there have been 14 new Mersenne primes.
So would 3 be an example of a Mersenne prime?
Yes. Yes. Because the formula is M for Mersenne. For some integer, and I think equals 2 to the power of n minus 1. But I'm not very sure what that means.
Because 2 to the second power is 4, 4 minus 1 is 3.
That's right,
right.
Yes. So, according to Wikipedia, the first terms, I don't know what that means, are 3, 7, 31, and 127. So yeah, and there's you know you talked about Gotta Catch 'Em All, because there's also a database called the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search, GIMPS. And yes, there's a database which basically consolidates all the Mersenne primes.
Ah! Nice.
Yes, so that's my bit. Sorry.
Nerd. I like it though. I like it. Ted
really?
Knight would approve. Ted Knight would approve.
Okay. Good job, Lydia. Good Asianing.
See, now I feel you've made it racist. I don't know.
No.
I'm not Ted sure Knight. If Armingod would like you call it Asianing.
No, I mean, this is so funny. Okay, because the interesting thing is, I've never lived out of Asia, so I don't really know what it means to be an Asian. Because this is so stupid. Because I don't feel like I've had to be different as an Asian, you know, identity wise. So sometimes there've been like instances where I've been grouped as the Asian in a. But I'm like, dude, I grew up in Asia, so I don't really get what you're saying. But okay, I understand you have your struggles. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's like where I come from, white people are the minority. So
it's true. It's true.
Right.
In our relationship, I'm the minority.
Yes. Yeah, because you know, when I first came to Japan, it was like, wow, I see white people. When I first came to Japan, it was for there was a conference for JET. Yeah, I was in coming to Japan to be an English teacher, and there was like thousands of foreigners there, and only a small number was. From like me, Asian. So most of the what do you call it, ALTs were from what we call the Big Seven, which is the seven passports that are instantly recognized as native English speakers. South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and so on and so forth. And of course, US and the UK.
I find it fun that you started off with South Africa.
Oh yes, I didn't want to forget, so I started with the Mino ones first. So, and I actually have a South African ALT friend here in this part of Japan. So I just so I didn't forget them, I should have stayed them first. Yeah.
I still remember on my like JET orientation.
you know, they had the different nights of like, oh, and this group is meeting up and this group is meeting up.
Yes,
And you make like a kind of a small group of friends for those first couple of days, and then more than likely you're not going to see any of them again. Well, I still remember, I can't remember if it was the first full night or the second full night, but the group of people I know, like they had a, you know, one friend was going to like the Irish jet group meeting, and another person was going to like a different country's group meeting, and blah blah blah, and like as all these people are going off to go kind of do their things, and I'm just kind of like, wait, but I don't know. And so it got to the point where the only people left in the lobby of the hotel were me and the jets of Asian descent. I was like, guys, I know I'm not Asian, but everyone I know just took off. And, you know, can I have dinner with y'all? So I got to be the honorary Asian friend. I'm like, I'm sorry to crash the party, but I just don't want to have dinner. My second night in Japan, and I had dinner alone. How fantastic. But so yeah, I got to crash that party.
Nice, nice. Yeah, but that would have been a really interesting experience.
Starman number 24.
Yes,
Starman 24 is going to be a little complex to synopsisize.
Okay.
Because in a way, it is three stories. There's very much a dedicated first half, and then it's kind of two stories being told on top of each other. But I'm going to do my best to give a clear synopsis. The easiest one is the first half, where Jack is going to somewhere between an asylum or a mental care facility and a prison, because he is going to go visit the Mist to find a little bit about the history of the Mist and to return the missing metal that has been the source of a lot of crimes and searches by Jack. So he returns that, has a nice little conversation with Mr. Crazy Pants. And then he goes on to talk with Hope O'Dare, who they somehow just stumble into each other. Over the next couple of pages, we get Jack and Clarence finding out about the recent, a.k.a. happened about five issues ago, events of the O'Dares and Shade trying to attack Merritt and get the poster, and Matt and Shade are gone and no one can find Merritt, so then they have to turn the underworld upside down through a handy dandy montage. And then they find the poster and find out that, well, the poster is going to be going someplace, so we've got to figure out what we're going to do. Hey, Charity calls, and Charity says, man, I think like I'm going to get killed. But instead of getting killed in this issue, at least, she meets the Silent Mason, who speaks for the first time all day. And while this has been going on, our story has been interspersed with segments of the Shade's journal, giving us details about Merritt and his travels through the world. And now Merritt's in Opal. So that's our quick synopsis over what really happened in this issue.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
Yeah. I really liked the first part of this.
Me too.
Yeah. We should talk about the cover first.
Yes, though, right? We should.
Okay, the cover is like I liked it, but I guess I liked it.
But you guess there's stuff you don't like as well?
It's not like I don't like it. There's stuff that I don't like. It's not that. Mm. It's not that. It's just I don't get it. There are angels on it. I guess they are supposed to be angels. Or do you call them like cherubims or something like that?
I think to be cherubim, they have to be the babies.
Oh, okay. So these look like what I would imagine angels to be.
Yeah.
And?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So an interesting thing about this cover is that I believe if we put, if we were to have issues 24, 25, and 26 lined up together, it would create one big picture. So that's probably one of the reasons why this cover looks incomplete, is because it's
I see. Yeah,
part of a big old picture. So, as this cover goes, I kind of get it. It's nice, it's pretty, it's well done, but it also doesn't really feel like much. And it works in the scheme of kind of what this story will be, but because it's just kind of Jack almost in a ghostly looking form with a yellow aura hanging out with angels as some stuff seems to be happening slightly off screen, it doesn't really feel connected or evocative of what actually happened in this issue.
Agreed.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still a pretty drawing.
It is. It is. The angels look very fit.
Yes, they do. And the eyes are kind of scary on that one angel. Kind of like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know...
Just the white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scary-ass angels. I can say that on a clean podcast, can I? Yeah, I can. I can. I can say buttocks. Ha-ha.
Which we do see in the picture.
Buttocks. Oh, well, we see... Yeah, we get some cheek action.
Cheek action.
Yeah. Shall we go inside the issue?
Let's. Okay. I've moved on to the first page.
Yes.
And we see Jack in a stairwell. Do you call this a stairwell?
Yes.
Okay.
If you wanted to push me on what's the difference between a stairwell and a staircase, I'd hem and haw and make something up because I couldn't really tell you.
Okay. Okay, in a stairwell, but on a staircase, I think.
Sounds good to me. Him, yes. Ah, make stuff up.
Pedant.
<don't> I really like how this kind of just opens off, just with that discussion of, no man, seriously, Ted Knight's awesome.
Yeah, exactly that tone. One thing that I liked immediately was how we knew instantly that they're back in Opal.
Yeah.
Like, finally!
Yes!
They're back in Opal! Yeah. And how the whole dad theme in this part of the first part of the story, I really liked it. Like, first, you know, you start off with this, with Jack realizing how people think of Ted, you know, in Opal, and then we have the missed part. Do we talk about the missed part now?
Sure. You know, I like that you put it that way because honestly, I didn't think of it as a dad theme. But now that you've said it, it's like, oh my goodness, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
High five.
And the phone call at the end, it also ends with Ted. So
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So The guy that Jack's talking to, he is I think he's a custodian or something for the facility. And then
I kind of went with the idea of either some type of administrator or maybe even a doctor.
Yes. So he leads Jack to the place, and then I love it because you don't know what he's talking about.
That's what you meant by custodian, wasn't it?
Yes.
See, I took custodian as like another form of janitor.
Oh.
But I was like, he doesn't look like he's sweeping the floors. I don't.
And then
it clicked like, right, that type of okay.
Yeah, the guy who takes care of the place.
Sorry about that.
Yes. So, I loved how on the first page I had no idea who they were seeing. And then, bam! Oh, yeah. It's the mist. Yeah.
I like that, and then I like that. Not only is this guy singing the praises of Ted Knight, but we also have Jack kind of being clueless as to the importance of his father.
Right. Yeah. I guess it's one of those things, isn't it, where you don't know how people see your parents. You just see them as your parents.
I'm trying to think what it was, but there was a thing on Facebook the other day where it was a celebrity kind of at a, and it wasn't like a huge A-list, everyone would have no doubt knowing this person was, but it was someone who I was like, yeah, that person's awesome. It was like, yep, my kids have no idea, are not impressed with me being famous at all. And I just made me think of that little side note, tangent, nerds.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like how they're just a member of the family. I like Stranger Things, and I love the child actors on the show. And one of them, the girl who plays 11, Millie, she was saying how her family just, her brother still says, you have to do your chores. You're not a celebrity in this house.
That's nice.
So, you know, it's probably one of those things. I guess if I had a famous father or something, it'd just be like, it'd be like that. I get you, Jack. I get you.
And then we get that bam moment of when we see that it's the mist.
Yes. I was like, why are you here? Why, Jack? Why did you come? And then, okay, but before that, do we want to look at the yellow box? The one that goes Sand and Stars and Epilogue.
Oh, yes. Like a prologue. You mean the one that also says James Robinson writer, Tony Harris pencils on various pages, also pencils by Chris Sprouse, with Wade Von Grobiger doing the bulk of the inking, but with Ray Snyder doing inks on pages 5-8, Gregory Wright's doing colors, Oakley and NJQ being the letterers, Chuck Kim being the assistant editor, Archie Goodwin the editor, and Jack Knight created by James Robinson and Tony Harris, that yellow box.
That's the one!
Yay!
Good job! You did it in mostly one breath.
I'll try. That'll be my goal next time.
All right. Yes, it's like, it just feels like a lot of people worked on this one.
Right? I think having the individual numbers for the pages make it feel like more than normal. Because we did have kind of a guest penciler for the Shade Journal pages. And kind of Ray Snyder. So we got two extra names than normal, but it does feel like it goes on a while.
Yeah. And I like how they titled this as both an epilogue and a prologue.
Yeah.
Special.
Yes. Okay. All right. So here we're looking at the Sand and Stars epilogue. I really like this. I liked how once we get kind of Jack in that first page saying the it's me, your son.
Yeah.
On the next page when the Shade is looking at him, it is that image of
Kyle. Yeah.
In that yellow. So we can tell it's not really real.
Yeah. And I like how, like, Jack, he put on his goggles
to be the glasses?
Yeah. Yeah. At first I thought this was some cruel trick, but then it wasn't. So, it was nice. Yeah. Okay, next page?
All right. The one where we got kind of the where Jack actually passes over the... No, he doesn't pass over the medal yet, does he? No, not yet.
Yeah. He's still, like, talking to the mist, and sort of, like, revealing that Nash is the new mist.
Yeah.
And over here, it's like he tells the Mist that Nash loves him.
Mm.
And Jack didn't need to do this, but he did. So yeah. I thought, characterization, yeah.
Mm, mm. Both not needing to mention the love, but also here he is trying to convince the Mist he needs to give his own daughter approval.
Yeah, yeah.
Approval in the way that she's doing evil and she's evil enough.
yeah. And I love the whole, like, self-deprecating, that idiot Jack Knight. It's more than he ever did for his father.
Yeah. Which is interesting as well, because, I mean, Jack's got to have the knowledge that, in a way, when Kyle was alive, that sentence would be true.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. That's very true. There was always a little bit of a parallel there, mm-hmm. where even though they were the baddies, they were pretty close-knit family.
As creepy as that family vibe was, they did work together in a way more than Jack, who was the black sheep. Might be saying it a little harsh, but at that stage he was definitely, acting out.
Yeah, definitely not close with his brother or his father. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how pathetic, and like the wet puppy kind of pathetic, is that face of the Mist at the bottom of that page, with like the kind of yellow
circle. It is, right? Yeah, I do see it. Very nice acting here. Did I use that right?
Hey.
Yeah, so it was like, it was, and that line, it's like, he thinks that Kyle is alive, he really believes it. And like, my heart.
Yeah, and even with that little, like, after that line, Jack's follow-up on the next page, again, it could have just been a simple, no, I gotta go, I'm gonna be busy. But he continues it with the, I have to remain one jump ahead of the authorities. Mm. He gives the Mist something that the Mist can be proud of. And it makes me also wonder if, in a way, hearing that type of language kind of lets, the Mist be like, ha, relive my glory days, chip off the old block, type of thing.
Yeah, and I also think he sets up a story for this, like, fake Kyle, because real Kyle is dead.
Yes.
So, because it's one of those, like, you do it out of compassion, where you don't want the Mist to keep pining for Kyle, so you just make up a story, and he has all these, like, multi-pronged reasons for, or excuses to let the Mist know that, I won't be coming again, just, you'll be fine.
Yeah. And then we get, like, the handing over of the medal,
and yes.
the reason for how the Mist got it.
Yeah. And I think Jack realized that the Mist, he really wasn't bad at that time. He pretty much saved his friends, his squad or whatever.
I wanted to ask you about it. I'm looking at kind of the next page, where we've got kind of the first panel is the Mist telling the story, and the shadows are forming the bayoneting of the German.
Yep.
And Jack's face what would you say that expression is representative of? Because I'm almost having an argument with myself of what that expression is.
Interesting. I thought that it was Jack learning that, oh, this medal is real. You know, like it was really because the Miz showed a lot of valor when he was in, when he was serving in the army. So not that bad after all of that face.
See, I keep going back, like, is that supposed to be a kind of exactly what you just said? Or is it kind of like, in a way, almost a look of horror I don't know, that much killing? Although, admittedly, this was during World War One, was it?
Yeah.
World War One, which, I mean, was... Yeah, I mean, it's still a brutal war. So, I don't know.
Now that you mention it, but I don't know, because I would think that Jack, he already has an idea of what the Miz is capable of. And I wouldn't put it past the Miz to have already committed, like, you know, heinous crimes and lots of murders, and I'm pretty sure Jack would have known about them. So I don't think, you know, the Miz's war heroics would really throw Jack off that much. I don't know.
I like it. I like it. I like how, kind of moving past that, on the bottom of this page, and the next few panels on the first page, I really like that through the art and coloring, we almost see the Mist, I guess you could call it, like, what, sundowning?
Yeah.
Yeah, with that red and that kind of, like, lostful look, and then the almost pained expression. And after seeing his nails for so long, and that little drip makes me think, like, he's probably squeezing so hard, he's cutting into his own palm a little bit. And then, right after it, the colors go back to normal. He almost has, like, a blank, empty look on his face.
And then,
for the rest of the scene, he just... his manners changes, his mood's going back and forth. He seems, you know, over the top, kind of crazed. But there's definitely a sense of something has changed.
I agree. It's a lot more real in the last bit, I think. He get, you know, when he sort of, like, rants and says, "Now your mother told me dinner will be ready soon. Run along and play until then." It's like one of those moments where you snap out of that thing and, like, okay, this is my kid, and he's not, like, 47 and a friend. I'm not going to, you know, commiserate with this kid. And then he's just like, you know, that he's a dad in that. In that picture, on that page,
And then there's that, he's that kind of dad, but he's also lost in a distant memory.
Yeah,
like both the ones with the kids as littles, but also with the back flashbacks to the war. But those final two panels where Jack kisses the top of his head and kind of walks out. I mean, there's some real just sorrow and sympathy for someone who until this point has really been almost the epitome of an unsympathetic character. It's the whole scene is just masterfully done.
Yeah, I agree. I also would like to link this back to that bit where Jack learned of, you know, why the Miz received the medal. And I can't help but feel like you know, in that moment, Jack just thought this was a guy who was brave, who did a lot for his country, but something happened and then he went wayward, and then he is now here and he's very pitiable, and he's old, and he has no family around him. He's locked up, and I just thought it was very humane of Jack to do that for the Mist, you know, you know, kiss him on the head and say goodbye, Dad. Yeah, that was really nice.
And even though on the next page we learned that, even though definitely an altruistic move, there is, you could make the argument that there is a little bit of selfishness to it. But even like somehow, even knowing that he's doing it so he can tell himself he's not the same as Nash the new Mist. It doesn't lessen the impact of what just happened to me.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, it's like this, isn't it? If he wasn't a compassionate person, he wouldn't have thought of something like that. I think it wouldn't even happen. The motivations might not have been 100% altruistic, but you know, the means were very compassionate. So.
Yeah, and I think this segment, because I think this is where we could pretty much say that the epilogue part ends and we're about to jump into the prologue. I think it was just, you know, excellently handled, these first 8 pages of comic.
Agreed. Yes.
And then we flip the page.
Yeah, we flip the page. And then, bam, we have Hope O'Dare. And she's like, she's really swanky, and those, like, she's covering like 3 grids and stuff.
Yeah.
I really like that. And it's just so, so kakkoi. No English word for that. I can't, what is the English word for that?
I mean, you see it translated as cool, but it's...
Cool, yeah.
We've talked about this before. Sometimes this comic, in the most glorious ways, is just an exploration of 90s fashion. We got the loose denim. We got the midriff shirt. Yeah. But you know, before it got to be quite so hip-huggery. You know, but it just, and then Jack in the leather jacket. I mean, really, this is just fantastic 90s.
I know, right? I know. My mom was up in arms when she saw that midriff bearing was back in the 90s, because, you know, we have all these primetime dramas in Singapore. And I remember there was an actress that my mom didn't like, and she was fronting one of the primetime dramas, and she had a midriff bearing shirt, and my mom went on and on and on about her. It was so irritating. She's like, "Why is she's old. She's not even that fit. Why is she wearing that?" Yeah, this was like 1998 or something. Or was it 7? Can't remember. Yeah, I remember that.
So did that make you want to bear midriff, or were you...
Oh, kind of... hell no. It was like the midriff, because I was a very insecure child, and I was very heavy. I was overweight when I was growing up. So yeah, so no midriff bearing for me. I would look like a donut.
Obviously, I wouldn't have. Nope, not me.
No problem. You stick to your Hawaiian shirt. Yeah. So, anyways, we have Hope here, and I'm like, when I saw her, when I flipped the page, I was like, Hope, you're here again. Yeah. Not that I really missed her, but it was nice seeing her. One of the characters from, you know,
we're back with our crew.
Yeah.
Feel like we're getting a bit more progress.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So, Hope has been looking, just want to say Hope has been looking for Jack.
Yeah. I like how, in this page with the three panels of Hope and two panels of Jack.
Yep.
We do get Jack addressing a mistake from an earlier issue that I didn't pick up on. The portrait of Dorian Gray as opposed to picture.
Yeah.
And it is just a little bit of them, like, in-world meta thing. Like, yeah. People make mistakes. Let it go.
Yeah. Wait, I did. Okay. Same. I didn't realize that they said portrait in the previous thing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that this was them trying to correct themselves. I thought it was, like, on purpose. I thought the shade made it on purpose, and I was thinking, okay, foreshadowing, maybe in the upcoming issues that there's going to be like a different book or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, but again, I totally took it as them correcting a mistake that was made, and also kind of metatextually just addressing the whole, like, people make mistakes, get over it.
Nice. Okay. Interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah. Alright.
Yeah, and then we just kind of get reminded of the problem. Mm-hmm. And then, the next page takes us, splash, to Shade's journal.
Yes, and this part is long. Mm. All the Shade's journal parts are very long.
Yeah. It's... So, this is kind of... I'm trying to figure out how exactly I want to frame my criticism, because it's not that I see what they were going for, and I kind of like that we get this chunk of the Shade's journal kind of telling us about Merritt's life.
Yep.
But, you know, it's nice and it's lyrical. Very little of it feels entirely necessary.
I know what you mean. It's like they're just like, it's like a history lesson.
Yeah, and having it spread out the way they do really just, it's basically like a stop sign to the flow of the book. It's like, all right, we've got this great flow. Wow, Hope's coming. We're about to boom. Oh, wait, we gotta stop here. Or I guess not even. It's like somehow we went from being on a freeway to being in bumper cars.
Yeah, like, I get what you mean.
Picking up momentum, we're moving. Bam. Ah, big wallet. Okay. Doop a doop.
Yeah.
So much. Well, I mean, yeah, so much to the point that there'll be a later section where. And I'll point out when we get to it, I was like, wait a minute, we must have missed something huge because this feels entirely out of place. But it wasn't. It was just due to the text of, here's Merritt. He was an academic who, demon stuff. And it's not that any of it's bad. It's just,
it
slows down.
Yeah. Like, was that much backstory necessary at this point in time in this issue?
Mm,
right?
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. And on a complete art mode, I really like Tony Harris, and I really think that Chris Sprouse's work here is also very, very good. But in a way, and this could just be because Grobbinger is inking over both of them, but there seems to be lots of similarities in it. So it almost, if you weren't paying attention, you could almost think that this is the same artist as the main story, I think. Although there's enough differences in it where it feels different. But, like, I don't know. Like, I almost think if they had either gotten someone to really make it look more like Harris's work or to get someone who was completely different. Because it's, to me, it almost feels like once we get to this segment, not only is there the roadblock, but there feels like kind of a dissonance note of like, wait a minute. Someone is not quite in harmony. But I think like if it had been just a completely different art style or an obvious break from who the previous artist was, I wonder if I would feel as dissonant. I don't know. I've been talking way too long now.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah. I wonder too, you know, if they did it differently. But we'll never know. Yeah. So.
And again, no disrespect to Chris Brouse, because he does a fabulous job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, though, that architecture there, what do you call it? Tudor?
I can tell you it's pronounced Tudor. I cannot tell you if that is Tudor.
Right. Yeah, so it looks like Tudor architecture. I'm not sure.
I will bow to your wisdom.
But yeah, that's very nice. I don't know. Yeah. I thought it was very intricate. I don't know. Everything was. I mean, very historical. There's one bit that looks a lot like Singapore. By the way, guys, I'm talking about the pages that are like in the Shades Journal, and there's this bit where I think Merritt was in the Indies or whatever. It was some part of Asia, and then there's this like this building, this white building that has like a dome on the top.
Yeah, with like the sailing ship in the upper corner and the
That's the one. It looks a lot like a famous hotel in Singapore. It's called the Raffles Hotel. Well,
do we want to go ahead and just get the Shades Journal out of the way?
Yes, let's go ahead and do it.
I mean, honestly, I kind of feel like after you've summed up nicely of it feels like a history lesson, and my kind of thing, like, it's nice, but I don't know how much of this at this stage is going to be necessary. Like, it's really, and saying the art's pretty, but feels kind of out of place. I don't really know how much more I'd have to say to add to it.
Okay, but you know, the content is basically just saying how Merritt got his powers, what he did, how he's immortal, and then how he like sort of lived through the ages and got pursued by people who were onto him, and then how he sort of defeated them or brought them to hell, and then we see how he's a master of creating like portals through art through like flat art or something like that, and I like I like that part where they sort of like said how someone else had done that with a Hawaiian shirt.
I like that too.
Yeah, that was nice. That thank you for that nod to that little nod to whoever did that Hawaiian art thing. And then we got being told that Merritt is an opal.
I realized another thing right now that I think kind of hurts, I don't know, me feeling connected to this section is I could make guesses, but in each of these pages, I could not with certainty tell you which, if any, of these characters are supposed to be Merritt.
Oh, right.
Like even on that first the first page, like I was like, well, I guess the kind of headshot and the guy studying, I guess that's supposed to be Merritt. Although originally, because he talks about Oscar Wilde and that looks like Oscar Wilde, I'm guessing that's Oscar Wilde, but it could be Merritt. I don't know. And well, there's a guy in the study, but maybe that's supposed to be someone. Maybe that's supposed to be a different So I never really felt like I was getting too much. Bah.
Right, get it. No worries. All right, then. Let's go on.
Yeah. So Clarence took the job after all.
He did. He's now the commissioner? No, wait. He's not. He's the... What is he called?
The liaison.
Liaison. Okay. And to you and other... And yeah, he's a liaison liaison to Starman and any other superheroes that may come to town. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
So, he's gathered his brothers and sisters, except Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Who's in a poster somewhere. And
like,
then,
like you are, yeah, every now and then, you know.
Yes. And I wish I was on a poster. I don't wish that I was in one. So I was on one.
And they have the poster.
They do. I was surprised though. How did I forget something? How did they get their hands on it?
I guess that happened off pages. I mean, it kind of.
Yeah, I mean, they are both. The Shade and Matt are literally like on the poster. Like their faces on it.
Yeah.
So.
On the poster? Yeah. In the poster?
Yeah, prepositions.
And metaphysics.
Yeah. And sorry, continue.
Well, I was going to say, like, so we kind of get that, and they need information about Merit because they do. So we get a nice little montage of them searching for Merit.
Yeah. That was some, like, badassery going on.
Yeah.
Especially with Hope. She's, like, just pouncing on the guy with the... What do you call this thing?
The pool cue.
Pool cue. Mm. Yeah. Against his throat. And goes, speak.
Yeah.
That was cool.
And I do like how... just like at the end of the book kind of really underlines or underscores, we don't get Mason talking.
Yeah. Mason is like, is he the youngest or is Hope the youngest?
Hope, I think they're twins.
They are? Wow.
Wasn't that a part of it?
I can't remember. But we know that he's the youngest brother.
Yes,
and that's the thing. So I think we read somewhere that he's kind of invisible, I guess. You know, like overshadowed by his brothers and sister. And I like the part where he gets one page sort of all to himself. And then right at the back, he's like,
Don't jump too far ahead.
Okay. Let's backtrack a bit. Where are you right now?
I am currently looking at the one where Hope is choking and wondering if we jump ahead to the Jack fighting the Mad Hatter.
Oh, let's do that.
You know, I don't want to dwell because I feel like I'm being more negative than I wanted to be.
Oh, okay.
But this was the page where I was like, wait a minute, did I miss something? Why is Jack fighting the Mad Hatter? I thought, does the Mad Hatter have something to do with Merit? Or is this just like a day of?
I'm just guessing that the Mad Hatter has information on Merit. Because that's what everybody's doing, right? Where's Merit? And tell us what's going on.
Yeah, and that's... But I mean, that was the thing of like having a random Batman villain,
right?
Just kind of being in there and getting there is like,
well, oh.
But then,
okay.
Like, if the Mad Hatter and his gang ever chose a worse day to pick Opal City for a heist, makes it also sound like just a random thing.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those moments where, because of the way this played out and the real estate of coming off that kind of wall of text to there. Yeah. I was really confused about what the point of the Mad Hatter thing was. If it was, like you said, the Merit Gang, or if it was just, sometimes you have to be a superhero.
Oh, okay. I see. I completely, like,
thought it was just them, because they're all like, ready, go, let's look for Merritt.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, I just assumed that the Mad Hatter had something to do with Merritt, but maybe, yeah, it could be. Like, he's just, like, fighting crime, it's my job. Yeah. But at the end of the day, he meets up with Clarence, right? And then they go look at the poster.
Yes. That's such a cool poster.
It is, and it says, Two Fools, which is so apt.
Yes. And I like how many times we see this. You know, and just kind of, I like that dedication of drawing it again and again. And from that first time we saw it several issues ago.
Yes. And we're talking, because this is a, but then again, I don't know. Do they like kind of cut it up and then paste it in the bottom grid, or do they have to draw it again?
You know, I couldn't tell you for sure. They might have just shrunk it down.
Right.
And kind of recolored it, maybe, because there are some coloring differences.
Yeah. I mean, like continuity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so they are using the poster to lure Merritt into the fold.
Yes. I had to look up, they reference a Roger Dean on this page.
Huh?
And I had to look him up, and he's a pretty famous artist. Kind of does, I guess you'd call it, surreal art. But he also does a lot of album covers. These covers often feature exotic fantasy landscapes, as written by Wikipedia. He's done a lot of things for bands such as Yes and Asia. And also the London Symphony Orchestra.
Cool. So
there you go. And there's a band called Atomic Rooster, which I never listened to, but I really like the name Atomic Rooster.
Nice band name.
Back to Starman.
Okay. So, would they put a guard on the poster, right? So there's like heavy security on the poster because Merritt is coming. You're going to lure him there. And then the brothers and sisters are just all kind of like gathered together in the office. When Jack gets a call.
And it's Charity!
Hi, Charity! It's you again! Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I'm Charity and I'm gonna get killed because I know stuff. You got anyone who can come see me?
Yeah. Yeah, and who is the one who gets to go?
But Mason!
Yay! Okay, so this part was really surprising for me because I was like, I did not see that coming. Yeah. Basically. Can we go ahead and like
let's sort of do spoil it, yeah.
Okay. So Mason, he just, there's this scene where he just stops his car and then he opens the door and then his eyes meet another's. And he hears his own voice before he realizes it. And he introduces himself and he says, "Hello, I'm Mason," and Charlie says, "I'm Charity," and then it ends there. And the magic is upon him. That's what the narration said. I don't know. That was like unexpected, and it was very nice. Like, I like the timing. The whole like, dun, dun, dun. Dun. Yeah, you know, yeah. You get what I mean. Yeah. So that was really nice.
Yeah, the last two pages do set up a nice rhythm that ends in a very, very good way with those two beats.
Yeah.
And the framing of the leaves behind both of them, the slightly different leaves.
Yeah.
It's just nice. I like it.
It's interesting how the leaves, you are like, you're in Charity world. Because you know that she's sort of like, you know, her place is very colorful.
Yeah.
Looks like a, one of those places in Japan where they have weddings. We've mm-hmm. talked about this before. Mm. Yes, yeah, so it's very resort-like.
Mm-hmm. It does look that way, yeah.
Yeah.
So, overall, what do you think of this issue?
Well, because it was so diverse, I guess, in its content, I think they wrapped up Sun and Stars really well.
Mm, yes.
Which is interesting, because we didn't really, like, super enjoy Sun and Stars, but we're pretty big fans of this epilogue, I feel. Mm-hmm. And then, the parts, I just felt sort of unsatisfied with the Odair parts, because, like, there wasn't enough screen time. I felt that the Shades journal stole a little bit of screen time away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I wanted to see more action, you know, that, like, instead of, like, more exposition, because essentially what happened in this thing after the epilogue was Jack meets Odair's protect poster, Jack gets call, Mason goes. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those times where I do wish I had, like, connections to kind of see, like, was there supposed to be something more here?
Yeah, you know, me too, yeah.
Because it does feel... It feels like there's a good, solid plot in here, but just that it didn't quite get the bat off its shoulder.
Yeah. I think if we were really, you know, one of those comic book readers who remembered everything that we've read... This would be like, ooh, Easter egg, you know, but I don't know, I just felt quite lost because of the sheer length of the Shades exposition.
Yeah, and I mean, because of that, admittedly, I'm not as familiar with some of the names, like when they start talking about the, you know, Ben Luddy and Hamilton Drew, and those names, like, okay, those are names, and they sound important, but they're also just kind of throwaway lines.
Mm.
Like, I don't feel, for example, that, you know, I'll need to know anything about American investigator Johnny Peril. I can tell you that in the art, oh, there's Etrigan the Demon, and it looks nice, and it looks like he's kind of fighting the monsters, but... You know, doesn't really add anything to this story.
Correct. Yeah.
In a way, you know what I'm kind of reminded of right now is last episode we talked about the annual, and kind of just like here, we got a whole, although admittedly it was only like two pages and not as much verbiage, but we got that history lesson of Prince Gavin.
Yeah.
But it felt like, whereas that served to set up the impact of that story that was, in a way, dependent on us knowing who this character was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure this tale will pay off in later volumes. I mean, we are only in part of one of three, but just in this particular issue, it's like, hey, here's a bunch of backstory that won't pay off until at the earliest next issue.
Yeah, I know. That's how I feel about this.
Yeah, and it doesn't the issue doesn't do itself any favors by starting off so incredibly strong.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It really put a damper on things. The not enough screen time or action or story.
To have that nice resonating punch of here's the best of Starman in its kind of serious reflective mood. We know it can also do high adventure very, very well, but we only kind of get teased with it.
Yes. So, unfortunately, you guys, we really liked this first bit. of this issue, but we weren't very big fans of the last bit.
Yeah, but you know, I can feel that change. I can feel that change of we're just on the verge of something super fun. So I've got hope in my heart that next issue will be back to us both really enthusiastic about this comic.
Okay, was that what you just said, that you've got hope in your heart? Was that a like hint for me?
You know, honestly, no. It's just me kind of going like, we're in a rough patch here, but there's a reason that this is one of my favorite comic series. That there's a reason I've read it at least three times, start to finish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And I don't quite know when we'll get that turn to where I'm just completely on board for almost every single issue, but I know it's coming.
Okay.
Where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, and my username is Quack Channel. That's Quek's channel. And then you can also just, I don't know, Google me and find me on Facebook and whatever. So I'm on every social media platform.
Everywhere.
I'm seriously on every social media platform. Like, I just got Tumblr, so.
Yeah, I just recently did Tumblr too, but all I'm really using it for is to almost reblog the same stuff I'm doing on my main website, which is deadlytroubadour.com.
Oh, okay.
And if you follow that, you might as well follow me on Twitter, which is at deadtroubadour.com. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to Facebook. You can do the Brent Thomas author page. You can look for updates like this on Comics League International. I would really, really like it if a few listeners could go to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. That would definitely help out. And just, you know, enjoy the show. If you are enjoying it, if you're enjoying maybe some of my writings, you can go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/Brent Thomas, and leave a note. You know, I'm just thinking, if you are listening to this and your main complaint is that at some point during the episode you can hear my birds, I just don't know what to tell you, because they hear my beautiful voice and they just want to chime in.
Right.
Not much I can do. Pets, you know, you gotta love them.
Gotta love them. All right. Well, we'll see you guys next episode. Please come and listen to us talk about Starman like Starman. The geeks that we are.
Yes.
And, well, goodbye.
Goodbye. Hope and charity. Hope and charity.
Bye.
There's a Starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a Starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children boogie.